I confess that in seminary, there was a certain grouping of classes that I hated the most. They were the history classes. I despised seminary history classes, especially one class, one professor. You didn't want Professor Wessel Schmidt. Professor Wessel Schmidt would get up, he would have a little folder, and we would be studying some obscure time period and the theological implications of that time period. And he would sit there during the class and he would read from his little notebook. And he would read and he would read and he would read, and then the buzzer would hit and he would take out the pencil from his ear, mark where he left off, closed it, and put the rubber band around it, and then walked out the door. And then the next class period, he would open up his thing, find out where his little mark was, and then he would just read. And I was always fascinated because growing up, I also hated history classes. I thought history was boring. And then along came the History Channel. And the History Channel did something to me that I had never expected. It actually made history interesting. And in fact, now I am fascinated with a lot of the history that goes on, especially as it connects with the Bible. I'm fascinated. I did a deep dive into a guy, and hopefully if you have other stuff to contribute, please do so. How many of you know a lot about Alexander the Great? Yeah? All right, good. Only one person. Fantastic. You and I are going, oh, George, you know a little. Yeah. A little, like, yeah. When I asked Joshua this question, he goes, oh, Alexander the Mediocre. And so he's really, really not that great. But he's an interesting guy. He was the head of the Grecian Empire. And this is fascinating because of the rise and fall of many empires back in those days. You have the Assyrians, they rose to power, especially under a guy by the name of Sennacherib. Sounds like snack on a rib, that's how I remember his name, Sennacherib. And he destroyed the northern kingdom in 722 BC. And then along came a guy by the name of Daniel, and Daniel had a bunch of visions. I don't know if you've read through the book of Daniel, fascinating. And he has two visions, and they're essentially two visions of the same time period, but just with different imagery. He has an image, a view of a statue with different metals for different parts of the body, a head of gold, he had shoulders and chest of silver, I think, and then bronze of loins, and then clay feet, and then a rock comes and strikes it and destroys it, and you're like, what is this all about? And then he has another vision, and he's got these different animals represented, and it's really about these next coming empires. You got the Babylonians, they show up, and especially led by a guy by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. In VeggieTales, we just call him Nezer, Mr. Nezer, and he destroys the southern kingdom in 586 BC. After that, you then have the rise of what's called the Medes and the Persians. So this is this second group in Daniel's vision, and the Medes and the Persians come, and they destroy the Babylonians, and they rise to power, and yet they're this kind of split kingdom, the Medes and the Persians joining together. But then along comes this guy, Alexander the Great, and he's leading the Greeks. After that is the Romans, but Romans show up around Jesus' time, so that's why we always talk about the Roman Empire while Jesus is alive. So Alexander the Great, fascinating. He is a guy who had some military conquests that others could not conquer. There's one city in particular, outside of the city of Jerusalem, who was protected by God himself in many aspects. There was another city that was darn near unconquerable. And that was the city known as Tyre, T-Y-R-E. The city of Tyre, it was actually a split city. It's on the coast. And so it had a coastal town, but it also had an island a half mile off the coast. And that island fortress was you couldn't conquer it. People had tried, and what often happened was if the invaders were coming, and they always came from the north, that's just how the topography lay. They'd come from the north, and one of the first places they would hit would be Tyre. It's on the coast up in the north. And what would happen is as they'd come in, these people would often just hop a boat and just zip on over to the island and just hang out there. And it was well fortified. And also these people up there, they were big into seafaring. They knew how to pilot ships. And so the island of Tyre was so hard to conquer because you couldn't lay siege to it like you would other regular towns. Other towns, you would just surround it, you would choke it off. But with Tyre, you couldn't really choke it off because they would always be able to get ships in. Rich, do you have something to add to this? Yes, every attack on Tyre would fall flat. Yeah. Yeah. It's really bad. One guy who he really wanted to be relevant on this. So he's like, "Hey, every time you check the tread on your tires, think of Tyre." Yeah, so it was. I'm not going to do that. I won't even say that. Yes. So, yeah, and of course, every time they do this over and over, it's like they keep retiring. No, okay, yeah, I'm not even going to look at her. She's just shaking her head at me. Yeah, sorry, Dan. So Tyre, this is how bad it was. People would try to come and attack. They would flee, and they would try to lay siege. They can't do it. And in fact, in Ezekiel 26, there's this prophecy that's given where it says Nebuchadnezzar, it actually puts his name in there, Nebuchadnezzar is going to attack and destroy Tyre because nations are going to come against it. And it's this weird prophecy because Nebuchadnezzar's like, well, I guess I'm attacking Tyre. He goes to the coastal town of Tyre, totally flattens it. It is destroyed. But he thinks that he's supposed to then also go after the island. But of course, what scripture said was it was going to be nations that were going to attack it. So it wasn't just the Babylonians and then the Medes and the Persians were going to try, but it was going to be the Grecians that were going to be the ones that were finally going to do it. And so he laid siege to the island of Tyre for 13 years. That is a long time to attack a city. And guess what? They survived. And in fact, people were like, how? Like, what are we going to do? We can't attack this place. It's impenetrable because they had their walls went right up to that coastline, and so they had certain docks that they could just protect, and ships would come in and resupply, and they'd be like, "Hey, we're fine here. This is no big deal." And so Nebuchadnezzar flattens the coastal town, but can't take out the city that is on the island. Well, along comes Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great is on a tear. In fact, the book of Daniel, the animal that is associated with him is the leopard. And the reason why is because it is this fast-moving attack machine. And they are sweeping through, and they are destroying everything. The reason why, we Googled it, you know, why was he called Alexander the Great? Was it a self-imposed moniker? Apparently not, as best as we can tell, because Wikipedia is never wrong. But people called him Alexander the Great because he had this military conquest that was super. Alexander was incredible militarily. And so the first place Alexander the Great hits as he's now sweeping through and taking over is the city of Tyre. He gets to the coastal town of Tyre, and sure enough, still totally destroyed. And then he lays siege to the island of Tyre, and it falls in 7 months. What Nebuchadnezzar could not do in 13 years, Alexander the Great accomplishes in 7 months. Do you want to know how he accomplished it? Oh, George, do you know? They built a causeway. It's a fascinating story where what Alexander the Great, he went to the coastal town of Tyre and he took all of the stuff. According to the book of Ezekiel, the prophecy was that all of its timbers and all of its foundations were going to be tossed into the sea. And that's what they did. They tossed it into the sea until they built a half a mile causeway out to the island and then laid siege to it. This town that was unconquerable fell in 7 months. Fascinating. At this time, they had sent word down to Jerusalem, and because they're rebuilding, right? We're in the rebuilding process. So as they're rebuilding, he sends a message down to Jerusalem, and he says, hey, I'm taking over. I'm Alexander the Great. You will bow to me and just, you know, just submit yourself to me and that'll be great. And they send word back to him, we can't. We serve only one God, and that is Yahweh, and we're rebuilding, so that's it. And that made Alexander the Great so angry. And he says, I'll get to you eventually. He said, I'm going to march from Tyre down to Sidon, and then I'm going to hit all of these western coastal cities like Gath and Ascalon and Hadrach and Gaza. I'm going to go all through that, and then I'm going to come to Jerusalem. I'm going to wipe you out. Well, that caused a little bit of consternation for the Jewish people as they're rebuilding. They're like, we really don't have a military, and I don't know how we're going to survive this. And so they start praying, and God tells them, hey, you don't need to worry. In fact, high priest, you are going to dress up in all of your regalia, and you are going to take a delegation, and you're going to march out and meet Alexander the Great on the road to your city. And the high priest's like, oh, that sounds wonderful. Like, I'm going to die. This is great. He hates us. He's going to destroy our city. And now I'm going to go out, and I'm just a priest. He said, God said, just do it. So the priest's like, okay, I guess I'll do it. So he knows they're coming on, so he gets his horses, gets up in his regalia, and he's like, let's go to our death, people. And he starts going out to the road, and he gets out, and he meets the delegation, and there's Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great jumps off his horse, runs to the priest, gets down on one knee, and starts to worship. And all of his generals are like, sir, why are you bowing down to that priest? Why are you worshiping him? And he says, I'm not worshiping him. I'm worshiping the God who he represents. How did that happen? Well, it all happened because of a dream that Alexander the Great had, that he said, he recalled it about a month prior, I think. He had a dream of a man who was dressed in a certain way, and God had said, when you meet this man, you are going to worship me, and you are going to spare that city. And so he did. He spared. He had just destroyed everything, but left Jerusalem alone. We get a lot of this. Much of that I just shared with you is not in Scripture. Some of it is, but the majority is not. It was given to us by a Jewish historian. You've heard me mention him many a times, Flavius. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's one of those. I think it's Flavius. Josephus. He was a Jewish person, Jewish historian, but he went against his Jewish people, so he was deemed like a hostile witness. He was rejected by the Jewish people. He was much more now a secular guy, but he would write these histories, and he tells this entire story. Now, why do I tell you all of that? Yeah, Zechariah 9, verses 1 through 8, tell that story several hundred years before it even happened. This is even before Greece was even an empire. That's hard for us because we often think of how can this prophet predict that? Well, that's because it's not the prophet, it's God. God sees it, God knows it, he's planning this all out. And that's what makes it even more interesting, because Greece, not even being an empire at the time of this writing, it would be as if I said, hey, in a couple hundred years, we are all going to be under the rule and reign of Iceland. Iceland is going to come and take over the entire world. All of you would be like, huh? And I said that this morning, and Joshua said, ooh, how about Ireland? I said, yes, if Ireland, we're all drinking Guinness beer now because Ireland decided to just take over the entire world. That's what's so fascinating about this. And what this describes, especially for the people listening to this, is this powerful king that is making this incredible tear through all of these places, and just how impressive he is. Zechariah, that was probably one of my longest introductions. Here we go. Zechariah 9, verse 1. Oh, great. All right, here it is. You'll see actually the heading there, it actually says an oracle. This is a burden. He actually has two oracles that he's going to be sharing about future events. The word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach and will rest upon Damascus, for the eyes of men and the tribes of Israel are on the Lord and upon Hamath too, which borders on it, and upon Tyre and Sidon, though they are very skillful. Tyre has built herself a stronghold. She has heaped up silver like dust and gold like the dirt of the streets. Because they were seafarers, they also controlled a lot of the waterways and a lot of the commerce. They were wealthy, a very wealthy island nation, right? It's a little bit like Newport, right? They are just wealthy. They got money all over the place. They're like, it's no big deal. They are amassing all this wealth. And because of that, they're not only wealthy, but they're also strong militarily. No one can stop them. Oh, well, it says the word of the Lord came against them and said, but the Lord will take away her possessions and destroy her power on the sea. And she will be consumed by fire. Ashkelon will see it in fear. Gaza will writhe in agony. And Ekron too, for her hope will wither. Gaza will lose her king, and Ashkelon will be deserted. Foreigners will occupy Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistine. I will take the blood from their mouths, the forbidden food from between their teeth. Those who are left will belong to our God and become leaders in Judah, and Ekron will be like the Jebusites. But I will defend my house against marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for now I am keeping watch. Interesting. As they're talking about how incredible this something is going to happen, and all of these forces that were impenetrable. This is a lot like our lives, right? There are things that we believe that God is not powerful enough to conquer. I know that theologically you and I would say, no, God can do anything. But I think realistically speaking, we often live our lives saying there are things that God can't do. God cannot fix my marriage. God cannot bring faith to my children. God cannot or will not conquer my cancer diagnosis. I am facing things and I am completely unsure of them. I have a future and I can't see it very clearly, and I'm pretty certain that God is going to somehow leave me during this process and I'm going to be left all alone. God cannot do anything about the depression that is deep within my soul, and he cannot fill this hole in my heart because of this incredible loss that I've experienced. We say God can do anything, but practically speaking, we live as if he can't. We believe that there are strongholds, like Tyre, that God just can't take down. And God says, I can and I will. I will destroy all of that. There is nothing that I cannot do for you as my children. And it must have been very interesting as they're reading this, saying, wow, here we are rebuilding our temple, and then in comes Alexander the Great, and they're wondering if God is going to keep his promises, that Alexander the Great is going to sweep down, take over so much of it, but he's not going to take Jerusalem. And sure enough, all of it happens exactly the way it was. Now, this could be tempting, because at that point, what a powerful king. What an incredible statesman, probably, but militarily, he was always on his horse. He was always in battle. He rode stallions that were incredible because he was on the front lines of victory all the time. People looked up to him. People worshiped him as a god. He was even labeled as a son of God. And it was incredible because people thought, here he is. And I wonder if there was ever a temptation from the Jerusalem people to say, maybe we should get behind this guy. He seems pretty powerful. He seems pretty cool. We could really trust in him. And God says, I got a different king for you. And in fact, the next verses are going to highlight the distinction. This is the discussion of two kings. One king, Alexander the Great, who is going to be incredible, who is going to be close to being worshipped. People are going to bow down to him. People are going to fear him. People are going to worship him. People are going to trust in him. And God says, whatever you do, don't. There is a better king for you. And let me tell you about this king. He's going to be humble. Oh, no, I don't want that. He's going to be meek. Oh, man, a leader who is meek? Oh, that sounds terrible. He is going to be a conqueror. Yes, a conqueror who comes in on a donkey. You might have heard these next verses. They're often used whenever we hit that wonderful celebration of what we call Palm Sunday. That's why I put some green in the background or palms, and we sang Hosanna, praises rising, because this is the passage that is always used. Probably one of the more important passages in Zechariah, Zechariah 9:9. Zion, you have a different king. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation. Yes, our king is coming, and he's going to bring righteousness, and he's going to bring salvation. He's going to save us. He's going to rescue us. It's going to be wonderful. Tell me about the war horse he's coming in on. Gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. He's coming in not with great power, He's coming with great power, but in a way that you and I would never even imagine. Tell me, have there ever been times in your life when God has shown up because of a prayer request that you had given, and that prayer request was fulfilled, but in a way you had no idea it was going to be done? Yeah. We all face those times. We all want God to come in this incredible, outstanding way and do something that will be for us, and it'll be the way that I want it to be. And then God comes in and says, I've got something better for you. I've got something different for you. Your prayer request will still be granted, and this gift I'm giving you is so much bigger, so much greater. It's a lot like, have you ever seen that picture? It's of a little girl, and she's clutching onto a teddy bear, and there's Jesus, and he's kneeling down, and he's like, I got something better for you, and he's trying to, like, give me the teddy bear, and behind Jesus' back is this monstrous, gigantic teddy bear. I got something bigger and better, and yet there we are clutching that teddy bear. No, don't take this away from me, and we scream, and we yell, and we're like, God, why are you doing this, and why don't you answer my prayers the way I want them to be, and God says, yeah, I got something better for you. I got something different for you. And that's how God operates. God operates by giving you stuff that you couldn't even imagine that you needed. And he shows up in ways that are incredible. I think we all have stories like that. We all have stories where God comes not the way we want, but the way he needs to be. And he's reminding his people. And that's why the Israelite nation is trying to struggle. Which one do I follow? Do I follow the earthly king, this king that's powerful, this king that's taken over the entire world? Should we follow that? And God says, what I want you to do is I want you to follow Jesus. And all of the writers, as they looked at Jesus coming into Jerusalem on that week of Passover, when he shows up and he grabs the donkey, right, and he's riding on, and people start just grabbing some palm branches and clothes, and it's really fascinating, this group trying to extol Jesus as king. Everyone picked up on it. This is the king we need. This is a king who is healing the sick. This is a king who is loving the outcasts. This is a king who is challenging the religious status quo. This is the king who gets down in the dirt in order to save a woman caught in adultery. This is a God who goes to where the lepers are at and stands among the unclean and then touches them to provide them healing. And they realize that's the king that we need. I know it's tough when we face things in our life and things aren't going the way we want them to, but God shows up in ways that are incredible. And which king are we going to follow? Are we going to follow a king that's just going to give us stuff? Are we going to just follow a king because everyone else is following that king? Or do we follow Jesus, who comes in humbly, who comes in quiet, who comes in and shows us something different, that he's going to conquer things, but he's not going to do it with bows and arrows. He's not going to do it with slingshots. He's going to do it in a totally different way. He's going to do it by humbly dying on behalf of you and me. Back then, if you were a king and you died, well, there'd just be a fight for your throne, right? There's going to be some vacuum of leadership and someone's going to arise. And yet when Jesus dies, what happens? Sin is conquered. Death is conquered. You are forgiven. You are loved. I think that's just incredible. I'm going to put my money on that king. I want to follow that king. And again, it's a reminder for us which king we're going to follow. And yet God still has a purpose for us. We often sit around, and again, I said it before, the holy huddle, we're just hanging out, and it's just really wonderful, but God has a purpose for us. And let me keep going. Again, we often, with Zechariah 9:9, right, that's all we read. Right? We get Palm Sunday, and we read that, and we're like, oh, it was prophesied in the past, and then we don't really have any of the context. That's why I love studying Zechariah in this verse by verse, helping us understand. Verse 10, look at that. He says, I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. Wait, how is he going to conquer? Well, I thought he's getting rid of the chariots and the horses and the swords and the bows and arrows. Yeah, he says, I'm going to come and conquer this stuff, but in a totally different way. I'm going to die on your behalf. I'm going to die in your place, in your stead. Woo. And what will he do? He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river, not the river to the sea, the river to the ends of the earth. This is a kingdom that's going to be much bigger, much grander, much greater than something that's temporal. Something that just exists here and now. He's got something bigger for you. He doesn't just want to give, he wants to give you blessings in this life. He wants to be with you. He wants to help you. He wants to aid you. But the most important thing to him is, will you be a part of his kingdom for eternity? And that is his number one goal. And that's the reason why he died, for you and for me. Verse 11, as for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. Yeah, that's why every time we do communion, what do we say when we hit the wine? Take and drink, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. He's talking about how his blood is going to save us. His death is going to save us, and we remember that every time we celebrate that. Verse 12, return to your fortress, O prisoners of hope. Isn't that a great title, O prisoners of hope? Do you have hope? Like, I know things can be bad. I know things can be difficult. But we always have hope. You may feel like you are in a waterless pit. You may feel like you're at the bottom of a cistern. You may feel like all I'm trying to do is get out of this pit. And I'm clawing, I'm climbing, and I'm trying to do that. And God says, I'm going to give you hope, because no matter what happens, you will be rescued. You will be saved. Things will eventually turn around. And have hope. And I love it because in the middle of verse 12, even now I announce that I will restore twice as much to you. I will bend Judah as I bend my bow and fill it with Ephraim. I will rouse your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and make you like a warrior sword. I love when people read that stuff. And because I read that, I'm like, oh, wow, he called out Greece. Like, that's some great food there. Some great islands, Greece. Why Greece? Again, this is a prophecy prior to Greece coming into. A lot of people think this was inserted later. No, this was a prophecy about what was going to be happening with that Grecian empire coming down. And you don't need to worry because God is going to use us. Did you hear? Put that. I will bend Judah as I bend my bow and fill it with Ephraim. That means Ephraim is the arrows. And why Judah and Ephraim? This would just be code for the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, all of Israel, God's people. God is going to use you somehow, in some way, to do something incredible. And it's going to be in a way that you probably won't understand, in a way you probably won't know. But God does those things. Last week, I got a chance to chat with someone who needed to come up to me and tell me. So I just have to tell the story because I just find it very fascinating. He was doing a shoot. He's a filmmaker, and so he's doing some stuff over here at Searchlight. And he had a friend of his that lived somewhere else, and she was total atheist. She was like, I'm not a believer, but this guy is like a believer, and he's like, wanting to help this girl out. So she comes, and she does stuff with him. And after that is all done, it wasn't even overt. It wasn't even like, hey, we're going to sit you down. What's going to happen to you when you die? Let me tell you about Jesus. It's amazing. He instead just lives his life, and he's doing all of this incredible stuff. And guess what happens? The girl is now a believer. God used a filmmaker, a college filmmaker, to reach someone from the East Coast. Incredible. God is going to use you to do something incredible. I get jazzed whenever I hear stuff like that. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. And then God gives this promise of what it's going to be like when you are saved, when you are being used by God. How will your life be? Verse 14, then the Lord will appear over them. His arrow will flash like lightning. The sovereign Lord will sound the trumpet. He will march in the storms of the south, and the Lord Almighty will shield them. They will destroy and overcome with sling stones. Right, yeah. Sling stones. Yeah, this is not really an efficient way to do battle. Like, and I think if you know who was the most famous sling stone thrower? David, right? Yeah. And a lot of people like, why did David use a sling stone? And I have a much different viewpoint on that. I think that David used a sling stone because God wanted to use something that he wasn't necessarily proficient at. Some people are like, oh, David was a proficient sling stone thrower. Then how come it's not mentioned in anywhere of all of Scripture? You know what David was good at? Hand-to-hand mortal combat. He would be the MMA championship, the UFC. I'm sure he'd be a small guy, welterweight or feather. I don't know all the weights. This guy, because he talked about it when they would go out and battle, and he was getting ready to battle Goliath, right? And Goliath is huge. He's 10 feet tall, and he's got all these massive stuff. And you know what David says? You know what? I've tackled bears and ripped them apart with my bare hands. That's unbearable. That's unbearable, I know. It is true. If you put shoes and socks on a bear, he still has bare feet. He would take lions and rip them up. Who here would do that? Would any of you be like, yeah, I think I'll take on a lion? I'd be like, no, I think I'm not going to stick my head in it. I'm not going to do any of that. Like, I'm going to stay away from that. Bears? No, 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 no. I've watched Revenant. That's a crazy movie. And a bear is going to kill me. Exactly. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, Ethan. It's nutty. So that's why David, he's like, let me go after this guy. I'll take Goliath. I think he would have like slid through Goliath's legs. He would have jumped up on his back. He would have choked him out. And then he would have snapped his neck. And then he would have ripped his face open and been like, yes, I win. And God says, go grab some sling stones. Sling stones? Huh? Well, that's not, I don't want that. And God says, that's how you're going to do it. Wait, I got to stand from far away and sling it? Yeah, when God uses you, he's going to use you in ways that maybe you didn't even know about. The times that God has used me in ways that I had not even imagined is incredible. And it, again, not because of me. God used me. I'm a really good preacher. God used me to, I will become America's preacher. No, you will not. You will be this little guy, and you will do stuff, and you're going to affect people's lives, but in ways that you didn't really think about. Will you allow God to use you in ways that you didn't think about? Yeah. Sling stones. And I love it because he says, you're going to have such great joy when you do this. When you are used by God, when you have a trust and a salvation, not in an earthly king, but in a heavenly king, and you are used by God and you watch what God does through you, they will drink and roar as with wine. They will be full like a bowl used for sprinkling the corners of the altar. The Lord their God will save them on that day as the flock of his people. They will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown. Do you see how much you are loved by God? Rejoice. Have some parties. And I love this. How attractive and beautiful they will be. I am so beautiful. I'm so attractive. And I love this. I won't get too deep into this. Grain will make the young men thrive and new wine, the young women. Yeah, there's going to be some parties and stuff. A lot of people see a lot of connection to the wedding of Cana at this point. I couldn't quite find it, but I thought it was interesting that what is the very first miracle that Jesus does while he is here on earth? He turns water into wine. Are you kidding me? Do you think God is boring? Do you think Jesus is some like German stoic sitting up, you know, not smiling too much, blowing his whistle, stop having fun? You get it? You turned 80 gallons of water, 80 gallons, gallons of water into wine. God wants us to celebrate. He is going to give you blessings. And again, maybe that blessing's not going to come in the way we want it. It may not show up the way we want it to be, but he will do it, and he will bring joy into your life if you will allow him to use you. So what king are you going to trust in? What king are you going to hope in? Something earthly, something temporal. Something that looks impressive, but really is going to eventually fall. Or do we worship the God who came to this earth holy, lowly, humbly, riding a donkey, giving us salvation, not from the things of this world, but from our sin, and giving us the promise of everlasting life, where he will be with us forever. I think that's the king I'm going to follow. How about you?